So, folks, you're joining us today on the Made to Pray podcast. And as you know, we like to keep things interesting, bringing lots of different representatives on from the scene across not just the UK, but the world itself. And we are joined today by Sergeant Major Billy White, and he is a member of the US Old Guard, Fife and Drum Corps. Billy, you're very welcome with us on the podcast today, mate. Great to have you.
Glenn, thanks for having me on. This is a great opportunity. I love the book, and reading the book last month, there was so much about your story getting into the scene that was familiar to me. After I heard your interview with Mark Riley, I went back and started listening to the podcast from the beginning. And I'm a little behind right now. I haven't kept up on season two. And I guess you're almost into season three at this point, right?
Yeah, we're into season three already. We're about four episodes in. So episode four comes out on Monday. And I think when we get this episode done, we are pretty much done for season three already. So in terms of recordings being done and everything, so it's been good crack. So it has, you know. So it's been great just to connect with people's stories, to be honest with you. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Just to hear where people have come from and the similarities, even though there is, you know, different countries, different continents, different, you know, backgrounds, all sorts of stuff. There's this real connection that seems to happen between flute bands, fife and drum bands, drum corps, whatever. It's just something really sort of unique and special about that.
Yeah. And I mean, so much of what I've heard listening to the podcast, as far as I've gotten anyway, is it's kind of universal, you know. I mean, whether it's in Ireland or, you know, when you've had conversations with is it Stu and a couple of the folks from the Guards bands.
That's right.
Or, you know, our experiences over here in the US, there's a sense of community about the whole thing that this has been my life for my whole life. So, I'm not really sure if this kind of sense of community exists in other places, but I know it's special within the fife and drum or, you know, over in the UK, the flute band world.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. It's amazing just how much, you know, when you talk to people about what they've got out of it, how the same things come out over and over and over again, you know. And it's just, for me, it's definitely unique. And but it's also maybe something that doesn't get, you know, a lot of credence or a lot of publicity in terms of, you know, what it does for people as individuals and so on. I think that's, you know, really important that we get to share that, you know, because that just, for me, lifts the lid on the whole side of the culture. You know what I'm saying? It's not just about this. The music's just an important part of it, but there's so much more that comes with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Alrighty. No worries. Well, so what we'll do is, Billy, we'll get started how we normally do with people. I don't know, you're a wee bit concerned because obviously we've featured a lot of flute bands and stuff like out there, and whether the questions would translate or not. But, you know, I think they do. They translate very well. So let's get kicked off with then. How did you first get involved with fife and drummer? What sparked your interest?
Well, I was kind of born to it almost. Both my parents, my mother and father, were both fifers when they were young. I was born in a town called Williamsburg, Virginia, which has a big living history museum in it. It's a recreated town from colonial Virginia. So pre-American Revolution.
Okay.
And one of the things that this museum sponsors is a fife and drum corps. And my father was in that organization when he was a kid. And my mom was in a parallel corps specifically for girls called the American Eagle Fife and Drum Corps.
Right.
And so they actually met on a trip that the two corps took together to the Deep River Muster in Connecticut. They met and then a couple of years later started dating, and the rest is history. So then, I come along several years later. By that point, my dad had graduated from the Fife and Drum Corps. So they were both youth programs. So when you turn 18 and graduate from high school, you graduate out of the Fife and Drum Corps as well.
Okay.
My dad had stayed on as one of the two or three adult supervisors that supervise the kids and help manage the program. And he'd also gotten into Scottish fiddling. And so he was going around to Scottish fiddling competitions and Scottish games here in the US. And so I guess from the time I was 6 or 7, something like that, I'd spend the weekend following him around to Scottish fiddle competitions and just, surrounded by the sounds
Okay.
of pipes and drums and Scottish fiddling and other folk music forms. And then when I was 7, after a whole lot of badgering, I got my dad to finally start teaching me how to play the fife. And he taught me how to blow the thing. He taught me my first couple of tunes. And then when I was 10, I was finally old enough to join the Colonial Williamsburg Fife and Drum Corps. And so I formally joined the corps at 10. And then I did that from age 10 to 18 when I graduated from high school.
Okay. And what kind of tunes did your dad bring you up on then? What was the staple?
Well, I mean, the first tune I learned was a tune called Chester, which is an old American tune by a guy named William Billings. And it's commonly referred to as the first US anthem, first American national anthem. During the American War for Independence, that was the tune that the US recognized as kind of a common anthem.
Okay.
So that was the first tune that I learned. And then, of course, Yankee Doodle and some of the other kind of American patriotic staples. But then, on the folk side of the house, my dad would practice the fiddle around in the house. And he, one of his warm-ups was a set of tunes called My Love She's But a Lassie Yet and Duncan Gray, which are two Robert Burns tunes. And so, those kinds of tunes were always floating around the house. And so there was kind of, excuse me, kind of this parallel, American patriotic and then Scotch-Irish traditional music
Okay,
all
which is
kind of floating around the house.
so I guess that's kind of had an influence on you a bit later on in life and stuff. Obviously, we'll get into a wee bit of that as we talk about some of your musical developments and stuff. What was your learning process like then? What was your dad like as a teacher?
Well, I mean, I was 7 when he started teaching me, and he'd give me, we'd work on how to make a sound, and then he'd teach me a couple of fingerings and then kind of send me off to work on it. And then he used Chester as kind of a way to draw everything together,
All right.
and turn those random notes into music itself. I don't really remember a lot more specific than that.
Okay.
But obviously it worked.
Did it become like an obsession with you? Did you find you were practicing all the time? Was it something you were constantly reaching for?
Yeah, I mean, when I was in the Colonial Williamsburg Corps, I mean, so that group is all, there's two or three adults that help manage the program, but it's basically student run. So when I was 10 and I joined the Corps, I was assigned to a recruit class, and a guy named DJ Baxter was my Fife instructor. And he was 17, 18 years old. He had worked his way through the program, was one of the senior kids in the program. And as you worked your way through the program, part of how you gave back was teaching the next generation. So it was, I went from my dad teaching me to this teenager who, had no formal education in how to teach other than what he learned when he was coming up. And the way that organization works, similar to your experience, you've got a list of tunes. And there was probably 8 or 12 tunes on the first list that you passed in order to get out on the street and march a parade. And then once you learned that list, they put another list in front of you, and then another, and you worked yourself through each list until eventually, by the time you were, in the main performing ensemble, because there's two different performance groups. By the time you were in the main ensemble, which they refer to as the senior corps, you've got upwards of 300 tunes tucked
Wow.
away in your head that the fife sergeant, you go out for a parade and the fife sergeant turns around and says, "We're going to play Fredericus Rex." And the drum major starts the tune and you either know it or you don't, right? So nobody wants to get caught not knowing the tune.
Sure.
Some of my first marches with the senior corps, we'd get d dismissed at the end. We'd do our right face and then walk back to the rehearsal hall, and then one of the senior guys would fall me and all the new guys in, and we'd go through all the tunes again because we didn't know them good enough.
Right, okay.
Impromptu rehearsal after the performance itself because we weren't cutting mustard.
Right.
And that kind of informal instruction, not at first. I mean, at first it scared me to death.
Yeah.
But I began to thrive on it, right? I mean, I was being challenged, and I didn't want to be the guy that let everybody else down. And so yeah, I mean, I would spend hours practicing. If my parents hadn't both grown up playing fife, I probably would have driven them nuts. Maybe I still did. I don't, I probably drove my brother nuts. But yeah, I mean, you got this binder of 300 some odd tunes, and you're expected to be able to play all of them at the drop of a hat. And the only way to do that is just to practice as much as possible. And it really drove you to push yourself. I got to a point where I was competitive. I wanted to be the best guy out there. I wanted to be the one that nobody had to worry about and that everybody was listening to because they knew they could rely on, And that was my, my teenage philosophy was be the best. And I don't know if I ever really succeeded at that, but in my mind I did.
I know. I have to say, listening to some of your playing, Billy, I would say you've done all right. So,
Yeah, I can hold a tune, I guess.
that's one way of putting it. So, because one of the things I did want to ask you about was the repertoire, and you've kind of went into it there. Because whenever I was speaking with Mark initially, and he was talking about how, oh yeah, we had to learn like four or five tunes and stuff like that there to get off, and it took a bit of time for him to get those. And I started to kind of think, good grief, is it a limited repertoire that existed there, and why was that? I was maybe thinking along the lines of, is there a limited repertoire because the parades are short or whatever else? But obviously, I've got the wrong end of the stick there because 300 tunes is quite the repertoire to kind of handle.
Well, I think that in the US at least, I think that depends on the core that you're playing with.
Right.
Because every fife and drum core in the US kind of has their own flavor. They've got their own kind of approach. The core I grew up in, right, the Colonial Williamsburg fifes and drums, that's part of an 18th century museum. And so I learned later that we weren't as strict as I thought we were, but we were, I thought, strictly adhering to, 18th century music.
Right.
And so there was this library at the rehearsal hall of popular music books from the 18th century. A lot of them published in the UK, but then, some of the early music books that were published in, Philadelphia, New York, and the adult staff would go into those books and look for new melodies, and then they'd arrange them for the core to play. And, all of those were documentable tunes from the 18th century, and that's the repertoire that I grew up on.
Okay.
What I learned later, growing up in the Colonial Williamsburg Corps, I had a really almost a sheltered understanding of fife and drum. I had no idea the breadth of U.S. fife and drum beyond the Colonial Williamsburg Corps. I knew there were other corps. I'd been at events where other fife and drum corps performed. My,
Right.
teenage self was like, "Oh, we're better than them. I don't need to pay attention to them."
Right.
We were very insular and very focused on what we were doing at the museum representing 18th century military music. And so it wasn't until I got to the old guard that my eyes and my ears were really open to this wider world of what was going on out there in fife and drum. And in the US, we've got fife and drum corps that represent the American Revolution. We've got fife and drum corps that represent the US Civil War. So there's a corps in Indiana that represents a French fife and drum corps from what we call the French and Indian War over in the UK. You guys know it as the Seven Years' War, I think. And then, beyond those, kind of strictly historical 18th, 19th century groups, the last 20 years, there's a group called the Grand Republic Fife and Drum Corps that they play bandstand music from the late 19th and early 20th century. And so, there's this whole spread of styles of fife and drum in the US that I was completely unaware of as a kid.
Though it sounds like, there's a, it's probably the same here. You know what I mean? There's been a lot of bands out here, and there's people doing different things. And sometimes you do get that insular approach. You focus on what you do, and sometimes don't worry about what others do. But then that changed here as well. We had a real, there was a period in the sort of early 80s where there was a real style change started to happen with a number of bands, and people really started to listen to that and take that on board and say, well, listen, maybe we don't have to keep doing things the same way we've always done them, that there maybe is, or maybe it is okay to mess around with these tunes a wee bit and change them about. And where you had your stalwarts where it was like, listen, if it says this on the copy, that's what you've got to play. So I think yous have got an element of that as well, where it's like, listen, you're playing this here, you've got to play it like this. But there's room for a wee bit of creativity.
Yeah, I think over here that distinction mostly is exemplified between what we refer to as reenactors, those people that are trying to represent 18th and 19th century military music as accurately as we possibly can 100 and 200 years later, right? I mean, and then there's, the folks that are looking to kind of expand the capability of the instruments, and explore new things, and kind of, any music is fair game. I grew up in something that's pretty closely related to the reenacting group, where we were strictly playing music from the 18th century. And then I got to the old guard, and my eyes and ears just kind of exploded
Yeah.
with everything else going on out there, which was really, really cool for me. And folks like John Benoit and John Chalia, and there's an album out there by two Swiss fifers called, the album's called The Twist of Distinction. And it's just two fifers. Every now and again there's a snare drum accompaniment to it, but it's just incredible playing. And what they're doing with the instrument just boggled my mind. It was great. It still is great.
Yeah. So one of the things you were talking about there was the difference between the fifes and you were saying that maybe the reenactors are using the six hole fife, and maybe the more expansive players or cores are using the 10 hole fife in terms of getting a more chromatic approach to that. And I'm just when I was sitting thinking about it, I'm trying to get a hold of a fife myself. I've been in touch with Skip Healy. In terms of trying to get one sorted out. And I'm just wondering how you haven't seen the flutes and stuff that we would play, do you? You have you we play like five or six key flutes. So I'm just wondering how close that would be in regards to what you would play.
Relatively similar, but there's one aspect of it that's a little bit of a mind screw at first. So, you've got keys for at least one thumb and both pinkies.
Yep.
The thumb holes and pinky holes on a 10-hole fife from, say, Skip Healy. You have to reverse your thought process for those based on what you know. So, in order for you to play an E flat or a D sharp, right, you would push down the pinky key with your right hand. Okay, so, but pushing down on a fife without any keys, you've got to lift that pinky up instead.
Okay.
And so you have to reverse engineer almost what you've taught your fingers to do with those thumbs and pinkies. I played classical flute too, and I learned to play the fife and the flute at the same time. But I grew up playing a six hole, and so I never used my pinkies or my thumbs. But playing classical flute, I've got all of those, keys. And so when I joined the old guard and I switched to McDonough style fife, which has those additional pinky and thumb holes, I had to spend some time kind of retraining what my flute brain was used to doing in order to do the same thing on fife, but by lifting up when I was used to pushing down. It takes a little bit of rewiring your brain to get
Yeah, I
it.
know. It sounds like it. Because what I there was a few tunes that I had got sent to me from the Connecticut Field Valley, and they translate pretty well onto the six keyed flutes that we were playing and stuff, And but then when I was watching the videos of those guys playing, I was like, "Hey, go, what's going on here?" The way that you're right with the thumb coming off and going back on. It's like, okay, right, this might not be as easy a transition as I'm thinking. I'm sure there's a lot of the basic tenets are pretty much the same, but it's like you're saying, it's this lifting off rather than pressing down thing is going to be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, the little bit I've played around with your flutes, I've been able to just kind of flip a switch and go back to my flute brain and use my flute training to approach your flutes versus my fifing approaching your flutes. It's kind of a at some point, with enough practice, it just becomes a switch, and you pick up an instrument, you switch to the right dial, and your fingers do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, the other thing I was thinking there is you already mentioned your dad, and you've already mentioned the young fella who was in the Williamsburg. who were teachers. Were there any other people who are influences on you, either teachers or mentors in terms of your plan?
Well, I mean, I m more people than I could ever mention. I mean, I was just saying, I did study classical flute for a little while, between high school and joining the old guard. I studied classical flute first with a lady named Diana Edwards, who was a member of one of the army bands near my where I grew up. And then Francile Ballou and Carol Ngo, at the university level. There's a guy named Herb Watson who worked for years with the Colonial Williamsburg Fife and Drum Corps, and he also was a historical music performer for Colonial Williamsburg. And so I studied some Baroque flute with him.
Oh, wow.
And then, that's kind of like my classical training, so to speak. When I got to the old guard, just a handful of folks that helped me open my eyes to the larger fife and drum community, Ross Andrews, Susan Brockman, Matt Ball, that first group of folks that I worked with as an arranger for the old guard. And then, I mentioned earlier, John Benoit and John Chalia, the Twist of Distinction album, all of those kind of informal things that help grow you as a musician. Just all of that input expanding my view of things.
Well, so obviously you spent quite a bit of time with Williamsburg. How did you then go from that core to the old guard? How did that come about?
Well, when I left Colonial Williamsburg, I thought I was done with fife and drum. Like I said, when I was there, it was pretty insulated. We were really focused on what we were doing, and it was a youth program. When you turn 18, you graduate out of the Corps, and then you go off and you do whatever you do with the rest of your life. And so I graduated from the Corps in 1992. And I went to university to study flute. And I was at James Madison University studying flute for about a year and a half. And then the opportunity to audition for the Old Guard came up, and my initial reaction was no,
Right.
that part of my life is over and done with. I've done that for 8 years. This is my focus now. Somewhere in that 18 months, my wife and I had decided that we were going to get married. And after some pretty good mentorship from my flute professor, and lots of conversation between my wife and I and my parents, I decided, well, it won't hurt anything to audition for the Old Guard. If I get the job, then I can do an enlistment in the army, playing the fife for 3 years or so. My wife can finish college, and then we can go on with our lives. And so I took the audition. I won it. I enlisted in the army. I joined the old guard, and I get to the old guard, and I'm immediately exposed to this whole fife and drum community that I was never aware of. And all of a sudden, I was hooked all over again. Coupled with the fact that, during that 18-month break, I really hadn't touched or played my fife very much at all. And when I started preparing for the audition, everything just felt right. It was like coming home. And so between that experience of rediscovering the fife after a break, and then getting to the old guard and being exposed to how much more there was in this world of fife and drum, I was rehooked all over again. Within a year or two of getting to the old guard, I started working on the arranging staff and writing music, which I'd never really done before, but like the Colonial Williamsburg Corps, the Old Guard does a lot of research into 18th and 19th century tunes that they then arrange for the corps to play. And so that research and going through tunes and finding the ones that worked well together and then arranging them for the ensemble, that opened up a whole new passion for me that I'd never explored before. So I mean, it was, it was a process like everything is. But that I think that, 18 month or so break between the two cores, if I hadn't had that break, I don't know if I'd gone straight from Williamsburg to the Old Guard, let's say. I don't know I would have stuck with it. I think having that break gave me a place to go when I came back to it. And that, I think, is what helped hook me for life.
And the whole process with the Old Guard then, is that purely music, or is there an element of military service there as well? As you know, I know when we talk about having the corps of drums here that are attached to the guards units and so on, that they know obviously they're seen as machine gunners first. They're all of the corps of drums here in the army are machine gun units, and they obviously are on active service and stuff. Is that similar to the Old Guard, or is that different?
Now, we've got a different experience. So our the Fife and Drum Corps specifically is a little different from the rest of the Army bands. The rest of the Army bands have an assigned combat mission. Their primary role is as musicians, but they have a secondary role, which usually has a lot to do with security in a forward environment. So if they were deployed, then they're providing security for the headquarters element and that kind of thing. It's not exactly the same for each unit, but as a general rule. The Fife and Drum Corps is a little different because we're assigned directly to the Army's honor guard. And unlike the corps of drums or the guards bands, there's only one Fife and Drum Corps in the Army inventory. And so there's nobody for us to rotate with. And so it's a permanent assignment to the honor guard. I've been in the Army's honor guard since 1994. And because that honor guard is constantly doing ceremonies for the Department of Defense, or for the president, it's a full-time gig. Now we do have some additional responsibilities in the Fife and Drum Corps that relate to the other things that the honor guard does. So one of the things that we provide non-commissioned officers to do is run a state funeral, for example. Or the last 4 months, I've been detailed out to our higher headquarters to help with planning for the inauguration that just happened. Because we spend, in my case, I've been in the honor guard for over 25 years now. There's a level of institutional knowledge that develops. And so we get tapped on a pretty regular basis to help plan those kind of large scale ceremonial events because we've seen them roll through periodically during our service. We are all active duty soldiers. I won my audition to the Old Guard and then I enlisted and I went to basic training and learned to shoot an M16 and throw grenades and everything else that any other soldier learns. I haven't had to actively use any of that since I got to the Old Guard, except 9/11. When 9/11 happened, I was in our performance uniform rehearsing for a performance that was supposed to go on later that day in DC. And when the plane struck the Pentagon, which is only 2 miles as the crow flies from where the old guard is stationed. When the plane struck the Pentagon, within 30 minutes, I was out of my performance uniform and into my my fatigues, and I was providing perimeter security at our headquarters building. And then for the next 2 weeks after, as the recovery operations were happening at the Pentagon, it was the old guard that provided the first military manpower at the Pentagon. Now, when I say the old guard, the old guard proper is an infantry regiment that the Fife and Drum Corps is assigned to. But so the infantry regiment that we're assigned to was the first military presence at the Pentagon helping with recovery operations. And the Fife and Drum Corps was part of that. We had folks for a couple of weeks afterwards, providing security, manning an ID verification point. We actually had about 2 dozen people that were part of a detail that went into the Pentagon to help remove remains. There's no getting away from the fact that you're in the military, and because you're in the military, there's any number of things that you may find yourself doing that have nothing to do with your primary job, which is to be a musician.
Sure. And if you don't mind me asking about the 9/11 thing, where did you kind of get an idea of the scale of what was happening in the country at the time?
It kind of hit in 2 waves. I said that we were getting ready for a performance later in the day. When the first plane struck in New York, I was in the locker room getting my uniform on. And I came out of the locker room into a common area that we have, and there's a TV in the common area, and everybody was watching. And at that point, everybody thought it was an accident. How does a plane fly into a skyscraper, right? And then we were all in that common area watching when the second plane struck. We saw it happen live on TV. And at that point, everybody's kind of just rumbling around that this is not an accident anymore. And then, so we're all just kind of watching this happen. And then, the drum major comes into the common room and he's like, "All right, look, I know stuff's going on, but until we get told otherwise, we still have a performance later today. So we need to go do our rehearsal." So we all traipsed ourselves down to the rehearsal hall and started doing our rehearsal. And then, maybe 30 minutes later, I don't remember the timing now, but we're still in rehearsal, and someone came into the rehearsal hall and said they just hit the Pentagon. At that point, without being told, everybody knew, all right, we're not doing this performance today. And it was just kind of an automatic thing. Everybody went back to the locker room. We changed out of our performance uniform into our camis, and it was less than 30 minutes later. Within 30 minutes, I was out of my performance uniform and then up at the headquarters building checking ID cards, and providing security. So I mean it came in a couple of waves, but it was very real, very fast.
Yeah, I can imagine. Oh, it's a scary time, to be honest with you, but I'm sure.
Yeah, and for the 2 weeks right after 9/11, I got detailed over to our higher headquarters to be a liaison officer in the operations center, which was right across the river from the Pentagon. And so, when I was I was on the midnight shift, and when I was on a break, I'd leave the operations center and go stand outside, and you could look across the river and you could see the glow from the Pentagon for a couple of days afterwards on the skyline. It was I'll never forget it.
Oh, I'd say you wouldn't, and I know that obviously the states them as a country. I'll never forget the day anyway. I mean, it's a massive impact in terms of the history of the country, I suppose. You know what I mean? It's a poignant moment. We all remember where we were the day that happened. And I used to work for the YMCA, Billy, and I was getting off a bus and to go into work, and went in, and the staff team there were a bit like yourself, gathered around the TV, like in unbelief as to what was going on. It was surreal, to say the least, you know.
Well, I mean,
So
and not just the US. I mean, that was a that event, that day, that changed the course of history. We'd have a completely different history to look back on for the last 20 years were it not for that day.
yeah, I know. It's hard to think about. Whoa.
How did this get this deep, man?
Well, I don't know. How would get this deep so quick, but it's obviously. It's obviously, well, the way I look at it is sometimes a conversation goes the way it's supposed to at times, you know. And let's lift the mood, and let's talk a bit about Dan. Obviously, you've been involved with the old guard for quite some time. You've already mentioned about a number of things that would have been, you know, highlights maybe in terms of doing inaugurations. But what are some of the standout moments that you've had as a member of the old guard relating specifically to the fifing and drumming side of things?
Well, I mean, there's always performances that stand out in your mind. I was really lucky. One of our responsibilities is to provide musical support whenever a head of state comes to visit the president. So I got to march in the arrival ceremony for Queen Elizabeth when she came to visit President Bush back in the early 2000s. And a whole host of other world leaders when they came to visit. And that's always a really cool thing to look back on. I mean, you don't it's not like you get to it's not like you're 2 feet from them and playing for them and you get to wave and say hi and actually meet them or anything. You march past, you counter march, and you march past them again, and that's it, but it's still one of those things that you look back on and think, wow, I got to play for Queen Elizabeth or Pope Francis or whoever it was. So I mean, there's all of those kinds of things. I got to be the drum major for President Obama's second inauguration, which was really cool. So that was 2013.
What was cool about that, Billy? Why that specifically?
Well, I mean, without getting into the politics of it, I'm a fan of Obama. I liked his policies, and I liked the direction that he helped guide the country. And so, for him to be reelected, well, for him to be elected in the first place was historic. For him to be reelected, I felt like that was a validation of the work that he was doing. And so it was special to get to lead the Fife and Drum Corps in that celebration of his reelection. Some of the performances that are not on the world stage are some of the best though. There was this one show that we were doing back in the 90s. And we for a long time we had this standing gig every Friday night during the school year. We would play for a school group that was brought to Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. called the Presidential Classroom, and they were there to learn about civics and how the government runs and that kind of thing. And they brought the Fife and Drum Corps in every Friday night to play at their kind of end of program, end of week banquet. And so, I mean, it was just a regular gig for us. You know, we did it every Friday night. They fed us great sandwiches. We loved it. This one night, I was playing, the show only had three or four fifers in it. So it was a small group, it was a dozen performers, three or four fifers, three or four buglers, two snares, a bass, and a drum major. And the group of fifers I was playing with that night, we clicked. And it just, everything was going well. And the Old Guard performances, each performance has a fife solo, a bugle solo, and a drum solo incorporated into the performance. And so we're in the middle of the fife solo, and we're just clicking. I mean, everything was going well. You know, we jacked the tempo up five, six clicks. I mean, one of those moments where you just know it's great, right? And so we're clipping along in the middle of the fife solo, and the fire alarm in the building goes off. And nobody stopped. Nobody, I mean, all the fifers just kept playing. We weren't giving up. And the audience just sat there too. They didn't budge. You know, fire alarm, and you know, there's a couple of kids in the back of the room and they start looking around or whatever, but everybody else was just, they were with us. You know, we had that audience. And you know, that's one of those performances that I'll never forget. And you know, nobody else saw it except the people that were in that room. So it kind of one of the things that makes it, you know, even better is that it's kind of that kind of kept memory for a very select group of people.
Yeah, it's a very different kind of experience. It's very much along lines, whereas the stuff around the inaugurations and the dignitaries and all that's all very good. And you know, it's kudos, you know, feather in the cap stuff. But sometimes it's that just basic connection with our audience and knowing that yous are in the groove and as playing as an ensemble together, that we are on it here. You know, it's there's something going on. And the crowd picking up on that, the audience being able to pick up on that and kind of respond about that's that organic nature of music, isn't it? Where it seeps through the atmosphere and the end of the soul almost and kind of just grabs people and you can't help but go on a journey together.
I mean, there's a power to well-made music that it's impossible to put into words. It's something that you just have to experience it. And when you experience it, when you're in that experience, you know it. You know, you can't help but know it.
No, and it's sometimes they're few and far between those moments though, aren't they? You kind
Oh
of you can
yeah.
go for a long period of time and there's nothing. You're still playing well, but you know it and it's probably it's a good thing that that's the case, you know, because if you're hitting that all the time, you know, it'd take it out of you.
Yeah, but there's that, but there's also when there's the converse, when one experience becomes, you know, an enduring set of experiences, right? So in 1996, the Old Guard went up to Nova Scotia to play at the Nova Scotia Military Tattoo. Which was a great time. I loved the performance. What I remember about that trip, though, is we were getting, they were providing all the meals and everything. And so we were getting, you know, a couple of bucks a day in incidental per diem, which wasn't nearly enough for the pubs at night. And so two or three days into the trip, I took my Baroque flute out, and I went out on the street and put a hat out and just started playing Irish and Scottish tunes that I'd heard my dad playing or that I learned in the Colonial Williamsburg Corps. You know, and so I would make some beer money during the day. I don't know, the first or second day I was out there doing that, one of the drummers from the corps shows up with an Irish drum, and he sat down and started playing next to me. And
Right.
so we spent the whole trip, the two of us, we'd go out and we'd play on the street all day long and have a blast,
Yeah.
just having a great time. We'd go back, we'd get prepped, we'd do the tattoo in the evening, we'd go out and we'd party with the tattoo cast and with the old guard, and then we'd repeat it the next day. You know, and that's how the whole trip went.
Right.
And that turned into a Celtic band with me and Matt Tourville, this drummer. We started a Celtic band in Virginia and played pubs in Virginia for 15 years, and you know, had a blast, you know. And so, you know, there's the relationships that they get developed through music too,
Yeah.
that, you know, one experience, that one day that Matt came out and sat down and we started playing together just completely impromptu, turns into a, you know, a lifetime relationship between the two of us as friends, but as musicians as well, doing something completely different from the fife and drum thing that brought both of us to Nova Scotia in the first place.
Okay, and I suppose that's maybe a nice lead into we were talking before we started recording about you released an album there recently, but under the name Confluence, throw another fife in the fire. Is that where some of that has come from? Is this experience that you've had at the tattoo of, busking and then going and doing gigs around a place? Is that where was that the embryonic stage of this project?
Partly. There's that album's definitely influenced by the Celtic band Edsel Road that I played with for 15 years. More so, throw another fife on the fire is stuff that I wrote when I was arranging music for the old guard that didn't actually fit the old guard's version of fife and drum.
Okay.
It's, you know, the old guard is doing public relations for and outreach work for the army. And it's, I don't want to say it's restrictive, but there's a style that corps represents. And some of the stuff that I started writing and started exploring just didn't fit the rest of what we were arranging for the old guard. And so I just kind of, you know, this is back in the 90s, early 2000s, before I was using any kind of computer generated music writing software. So everything's pen on manuscript paper, pencil on manuscript paper. And so I just kind of stuck all of this stuff in a notebook. And then in 2018, my term as the Corps Sergeant Major for the Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps came to an end, and Mark Riley took over from me. And I took about 2 months off when that happened. And you know, I had 2 months and a lot of time, a lot more time on my hands than I knew what to do with. And so I started pulling out some of this stuff that I had written 10, 15, 20 years ago for the fife, and started playing around with it again. And I decided, you know, this stuff needs to be played. And so I started putting together a group of folks to play it, and then I set up the recording session, and we went into the studio where we recorded everything in a weekend, and then put it out there for hopefully for everybody to enjoy.
No, it's strange whenever you put something out, especially of original stuff. I know there's a mixture of original and maybe other pieces on there as well. But talk to me a bit about that writing process. Obviously, we're saying that some of these tunes existed for quite a period of time. What is it that inspires you to write stuff? Is it just something that you're working on, something you hear in your head? Where does the original pieces come from within you?
Well, I mean, it's a couple of things, and it, kind of varies for each thing, right? So from that album, for example, the tune A-Team, I was listening to an album by Edgar Meyer and Bella Fleck called Music for Two. And it's music for banjo and double bass.
Right.
And there was this one piece that they played on it that was a round. Edgar Meyer would start out on the bass, and then 15 beats later, Bella Fleck would come in on the banjo and repeat back the exact same thing over and over and over. And that was the whole
Okay.
piece. And so, I thought that was, I mean, growing up, I had experienced rounds, row, row, row your boat, and all of that.
Sure.
But I was inspired to actually try to write something complex in that form. And so I wrote the middle section, the slower section of A-Team first, simply as an exercise, trying to write a piece for two fifes that was one mimicking the next 8 or 16 beats later. And then I wrote the fore and aft sections of it as bookends to that center, because I liked what I wrote,
Okay.
and I wanted to make something more out of it. And that kind of beginning and end sections were an attempt to write something that not only bookended the middle canon, but that were standalone on their own.
Sure.
And so, so that was kind of the idea there.
Okay.
Then, throw another fife on the fire. That piece ex itself, that one was inspired by a story that I heard about a fifer up in New England who they would have their rehearsals at this tavern, and during the winter there was always a fire going, and they had this running joke in the corps about when the fire started to die, somebody would say throw another fife on the fire,
Right,
and then
okay.
put another log on the fire or whatever. So the story I heard, whether it's true or embellished, is that one night one of the fifers showed up with a bunch of reject fifes from a fife maker.
Right.
And somebody said, throw another fife on the fire, and he reached into his bag, pulled out two or three fifes, and threw them into the fire.
Right.
And so, I heard that story and I thought, holy crap, that'd be a great title. And so I set out to write something for that title.
Okay.
And then, sometimes it's a rhythm. I'll get a rhythm in my head, and I'll try to craft a melody that uses that rhythm, and explores the rhythm. So I
Sure.
mean, it kind of varies. Everything that ends up coming out is not worth playing for sure.
Yeah. Need to be
but
selective with the creative process, don't you?
oh yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
everything I come up with, I write down. Last year, I put out a book of simple melodies that I'd written over the last 20 years.
Okay.
And it's everything, right? Some of the worst melodies you'll ever find are in
Right.
that book. But part of my process has become, that you write down everything.
Yeah.
And sometimes you've got a good idea, and sometimes you've got a bad idea. But if you don't write it down and play with it, you never know whether
Yeah.
it's a good idea or a bad one.
Yeah, exactly.
And kind of accepting that process is part of it, is part of developing yourself as a writer or arranger.
Yeah.
And so when I put out this book, in the foreword to the book, I explain, there's some pretty crappy tunes in here. But that's part of the process. You have to take the good with the bad.
Yeah.
And also, you never know, something that you write, you might think that it's crap. But somebody else might see it or hear it and have an idea that they can take it and they can make a gold mine out of it.
Yeah.
And so it's a shame to throw anything away, I guess. I suppose I'm a musical hoarder.
No. And I think that's a good process that you're talking about there, is to keep everything, just in case. Somewhere down the line you think, oh, or someone else hears it as you're saying, and they say, well, what about doing this? And it gives it a whole new lease of life. But you do need to have that critical ear on things as well, don't you? Because I've started doing a couple of original pieces for specific groups and so on. And you're maybe writing stuff, and trying to think of the particular group or band in particular, and think, what is it they normally play and how might they do that? And but I'm just conscious, I don't want to be handing them, as you say, don't be handing them a crap either. Do you know what I mean? It's like getting one, yeah, just because this is original, it means it's good, you need to be able to filter things properly as well, don't you?
Yeah, well, and like I said, I mean, that's where a lot of the stuff from that recording came from was there were things that I had written that just they didn't fit the old guard, which is the group that I was writing for at the time. And so I filtered them out. We didn't use them for the old guard, but I set them aside until I found a use for them.
Talk to me about, there's two in particular that stand out for me, and it would be great. What we'll do is we'll play these as part of the episode as well, Billy. But Joe's Journey and Jig for Jonathan, or I think that's the right name of it, isn't it? Where did those two come from? Because obviously they're original pieces, and I think they're fantastic. So, what's the story behind those two tunes?
Well, Joe's Journey is written for a friend of mine named Joe Mon, who's a phenomenal fifer. He is a member of the Ancient Mariners Fife and Drum Corps out of Massachusetts, I think, or Connecticut, one of those New England states. He came to the Old Guard in the early, late 90s. He came to the Old Guard. And when he did his audition, I mean, we knew right away we wanted to hire him because he's an incredible fifer. But he was really honest with us in the audition that this was a one enlistment deal for him, that his real goal was to become a firefighter. And that the best way for him to become a firefighter in his hometown was to be a veteran, because it helped you get higher on the selection list for the training academy. So, from the day we auditioned him, he told us, I'm going to do 3 years and then I'm going to get out because this is what I really want to do. And so, he true to his word, we hired him. He came in. We spent 3 years trying to change his mind because we wanted to keep him. But true to his word, he did his enlistment and he got out. And when he got out, he went back home and he did exactly what he wanted to do, right? He first became a policeman and a paramedic, and now he's a lieutenant firefighter. And I wrote this piece as a tribute to him, I guess, and the whirlwind that his time in the Old Guard was. It was a really brief 3 years, but he packed so much into that 3 years. Every trip he could go on, he was on. Every performance he could do, he was there. And he's just such a great player. You love playing with him because it just feels right. You click with him immediately. And so I was trying to write something that kind of encapsulated that whirlwind 3 years that Joe spent in the old guard. And Joe's journey is the result.
Yeah, what about the Jig for Jonathan then?
That one, that was a request. A good friend of mine, another fifer from the old guard named Don Francisco. He has a son that's got autism, and he when I started writing tunes back in the late 90s, early 2000s, he asked me to write a tune for his son Jonathan. And so I wrote that one, and he as an autistic child, Jonathan was a real kind of dichotomy. On the one hand, he could be super challenging, but at the same time, he was just this really happy, loving kid. And so I tried to write something that was challenging and complex, but also related a sense of joy at the same time. I think I accomplished what I wanted with that one, because every time I listen to it, I hear something a little bit different. And that's probably more a reflection of me and where I am in my own head when I listen each time. But I think that also kind of speaks to at least my perception of what life is with an autistic child. Or Jonathan's grown now. He's in his mid-20s. He graduated from high school, and he's got a job during the day. Still lives with Don and his wife Grace. But he's a functioning adult at this point. It's pretty neat to see the relationship that he still has. He and Don have got a really, really special relationship. And hopefully I captured that in this tune.
Are you still writing then? Are you still taking requests for original pieces?
I still write as I can.
Just in terms of your experience so far, what would you say you've personally gained from being a part of Fife and Drum Corps from the beginning right through to the old guard, and you're just the experiences of what have you got out of it?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, and this doesn't have anything to do with the music itself, but I mean, I am incredibly blessed that I've been able to make a living for close to 30 years playing the fife. My wife and I have been married for 27 years. We've raised two wonderful kids. And playing the fife for the Army is what enabled us to do all of that. And that's pretty amazing. And lucky. And, I don't know. I don't know what the right adjective is, but that's the first thing. The relationships that I've developed over the years. Mark talked about musters when you interviewed him, and these are weekend gatherings of fife and drum corps, usually in New England during the summer. I've met and made friends at musters that I'll see these folks maybe once a year, and when I see them, we'll pick up a conversation like we were just talking yesterday. The kinds of conversations where you're up all night sitting by a campfire talking, and the next thing you know, the sun's coming up and you're not a bit tired because the conversation has just been that good, and those kinds of friendships that have developed through the music, because it's the music that brought you together in the first place. I obviously learning how to write and arrange for the instrument is something that's become, I mean, it's become another passion. And if it weren't for coming to the Old Guard, I don't think that would have ever happened. And then, again, unrelated to the music, but no less important to me personally is the leadership experience that I've gotten over the last 30 years of fifing and drumming. I mean, starting in Colonial Williamsburg, because as a youth program with a couple of adults managing it, it's all the kids that do most of the leadership. So I started teaching younger fifers when I was 12 or 13 for the first time. And then my first experience is being responsible for rehearsing a fife line and ensuring that it was ready for performance was as one of the senior members of that group. And then, of course, when I got to the Old Guard, I had the opportunity to be a fife section leader and then the group leader, the main leader for the fife line for 8 years. And responsible not just for the music itself, but for taking care of the other folks, making sure, any pay problems were taken care of. If they had family problems, helping take care of them. And just, generally making sure that they were taken care of, had what they needed to stay focused on doing their job to the best of their ability. That leadership experience, and being able to use positions as a leader to help take care of other folks, is it's a whole other benefit that I never saw coming. Never saw coming.
Okay, it sounds like you've got just as much from the personal side of it as you have from the music, and maybe more from the personal and relationship side of things than the music itself.
And I would say so. I mean, the music is almost a means to an ends at some point. The music is what brings us all together, but then it's what you do with the music to develop the relationships, and then where those relationships take you that ends up providing kind of the enduring value of it all. I've released a couple of CDs now, two with Edsel Road and the Confluence recording. I've got a couple of books of music out there, and those are there. They're nice. I'm certainly happy with them and glad that I did them, or that I was a part of them. But it, the relationships with the people that resulted from those projects will always be more important to
Yeah.
me than the products themselves.
Okay. Cool. Where can people get their hands on your products, though? Because obviously there'll be some people listening in and going, I want to check this stuff out. So where can they get them?
Well, the Confluence album is on Apple Music and Spotify. So, I mean, you can stream it from either of those or download it or whatever. I've got a website called fifemajor.com that has, I mean, if you want to purchase a copy of it, if someone from the UK wants it, it's going to be a heck of a lot cheaper just to stream the thing than for me to mail it to you. The books are there on fifemajor.com also, and they're available in either physical format or you can do a digital download of both of
Okay.
them.
Cool. Brilliant.
So fifemajor.com, there's my
No
commercial.
worries. Brilliant. Well, folks, if you're interested in getting a hold of some of the stuff that Billy's come up with, make sure you do check it out. And believe me, you will want to check it out. There is some amazing stuff there available for you to listen to. I know I've been absolutely blown away by it and stuff. Just maybe in finishing, Billy, what are maybe your hopes for the fife and drum scene in America?
Well, I mean, I hope that it stays healthy and vibrant. It's a unique art form here in the US. There's not a whole lot of people that are involved in it. It's a little niche thing, primarily centered on the northeast portion of the US, with some outliers in the Midwest, and there's a couple of fife and drum corps out in California. But I heard a statistic recently, and I'm sure I'm going to get these numbers wrong, but it was something along the lines of 60% of the people doing fife and drum in the US are over 40 years old,
Right.
and 40% of that group is over 60. And so that tells you that the next generation coming up in the art form is smaller than the current generation.
Sure.
Which is that's scary, the idea that it's not going to continue as vibrant as it is right now, is worrisome. So, I hope that those of us that are kind of in our prime right now are able to continue to get more and more young kids involved. It's obviously been a great activity for us throughout our lives, because we're still involved with it. And so, helping a new generation discover this great activity, and the benefit that it can be for them, that's kind of a enduring hope and goal for the US scene.
Sure.
Beyond that, I'd love to see more of the groups that are playing now, get their stuff recorded and documented.
Yeah.
I mean, YouTube has been great. There are videos of performances for pretty much every corps you can imagine in the US. But I'm partial to kind of the formal process of building an album,
Yeah.
because it's when it's done right, it's a thoughtful process.
Yeah.
You put a lot of time and effort into perfecting the music to represent your group at its peak. And YouTube is great, but YouTube doesn't necessarily give you your group at its peak. It gives you your group at a particular performance, which maybe is a great performance, but maybe it's not too. And I'd really love to see more groups figure out how, and the funding and the resourcing is always
Yeah,
part of the problem, right? But
yeah.
figure out how to to do a really thoughtful recording to document who they are as an organization and their flavor of fife and drum, because then it's there, and anybody can go back and reference it and say, well, there was this fife and drum corps in 2021 and they were doing this super cool thing, and you can hear it on this recording.
Yeah. Well, let's hope maybe that's the case. You get some bands out there that will do that. I know that recording it has been a major thing with the bands here. It's been a major source of fundraising and stuff for outfits over here. There's lots of bands that have got their own recordings and stuff. And I think you're right. I mean, whenever I came across the Connecticut Valley field music CD, I was just blown away by it. I was just like, my goodness, this is fantastic. The arrangement, the Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, is outstanding. And an older wee tune, John Henry, is a great wee number. And then I think it's at the Hills of Virginia, is an absolute wonder tune. I absolutely love it. It's a fantastic piece of music and stuff. And I've been hounding the guys online, listening to send me your sheet music, send me your sheet music, because this is great. And there's already, I think, a couple of bands here are, I would say you're going to hear their version of that Swing Low, Sweet Chariot appearing with some bands over here pretty soon.
That's awesome.
I've been evangelizing like crazy, saying, listen, any opportunity I get, I'm pushing this music on them and stuff. You know what I mean? So, and hopefully that means that there could be some greater collaboration, going on between the scenes. I know Mark had talked about that, and I know I've kind of reached out to him recently about trying to bring a few people together about the idea of maybe trying to put on a muster here, and trying to get a few groups over whenever we're allowed to travel again, and be around each other and stuff. So I'd definitely say it'll not be the last that we'll hear from you, or maybe it'd be great to get you over here at some point, and do some stuff with people. I think it would be amazing for us to kind of have the scenes converge in some way, and then kind of and learn from each other, and cross-pollinate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I got to tell you, from reading the book, I mean, it's definitely, there's two things on my bucket list now. That one is getting to Fastnacht in Basel, which I still haven't been able to experience. But I now had to add the 12th of July, or maybe the 1st. You tell me which is the premier.
Either or works for me. Either or works.
But just to be on it, I've never been a fan of watching a parade, right? I
Right.
would much rather be in a parade because the scenery keeps changing. But
Yeah.
from your description of the 12th, I've got to at some point be on a street corner and just watch all of these flute bands come by.
Well, there's an open invite for you, Billy, if you want it. Anytime you want to come over, not a problem, mate. Just let us know. We'll work out how we get you here, and we'll put you up on whatever else, and you can come and experience the 12th or the 1st in all of its glory. And absolutely not a problem, man. You know what I mean?
That sounds fantastic. I can't wait.
Cool. Good stuff. Well, listen, Billy, thanks very much for taking the time to be on the podcast, man. That was absolutely fantastic conversation, and I'm sure we probably could have talked on even more, and maybe there's something for us to do, maybe with Mark and yourself, maybe in the future doing some stuff as well. I think that would be great for us to kind of to link in with, So for now, I just want to say thank you, man. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. And I've enjoyed this conversation so much. This has been a great time, and best of luck to you as you continue on with the podcast into season four. That's
Yeah.
pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's doing all right. We'll see how we go. So season four should hopefully take us to a year of being in existence. So we'll see how we go. But it's been great so far, and I'm just loving the fact that even in the midst of a lockdown and a pandemic, that the relationship building that we've been talking so much about is still able to continue, and that the podcast, the book, and Zoom and all these kind of things have enabled that type of thing to still, live on.
Well, and two, I mean, I know this is probably part of what you set out to do, but I mean, you're helping document the flute band scene.
Yeah.
You're helping, supplement all of those flute band recordings that you were talking about with an explanation of how they came about and what's different about all the different cores. And one day down the road, there's going to be some musicologist that starts looking into the flute band scene in Ireland to write a book. And this set of podcasts is going to be a gold mine for that historian. So congratulations to you, because you're building something with enduring value in this podcast, no doubt.
Well, I appreciate that, Billy. Thank you. Enjoyed that conversation with Sergeant Major Billy Wade there. I had an absolutely brilliant time talking to him and hearing his stories and just getting a bit of his insight into his whole creative process and what his journey's been like and some of the major positive things that he's done as a result of his time being a fifer and drummer. And absolutely been blown away by the original music that he's created. I really hope that you enjoyed listening to that as well. And we'll have another one of Billy's tunes to close the episode. So make sure you go to fifemajor.com, check out his stuff, get a hold of his music. It'll really stretch your plan for definite. And thanks again, Billy, for taking the time to be on the podcast for us. So the next episode that we have coming up will be the one that we were supposed to have out this time, which is for the Omagh Protestant Boys. We had a conversation with Kenny and Amanda Porter and David Montgomery around the band and specifically around the trip to Savannah that they had made. So make sure you look out for that one. We'll also have our current affairs bonus episode coming up very soon as well. And then we'll be getting really close to ending the season. So make sure you keep checking us out, folks. All right, so if you haven't subscribed to the podcast, then make sure that you do. You can do that in a number of ways. You can go to our website, which is madetheparade.com, and you can find all of our episodes there. You can listen to them there, or you'll also find a link there to help you be able to subscribe on whatever podcast app that you can use on your phone. If you're an Apple user, then you can get that on Apple Podcasts. If you're an Android user, then you've got lots of different options. You'll have Alexa, you'll have Spotify, you'll have all sorts of options for you to get a hold of the podcast. Also, just want to say thank you to our patrons who continue to support the work of Made to Parade financially every month. Without you, we wouldn't be able to have our website live. So thank you very much for that. If you would like to contribute to supporting Made to Parade, then please go to our Patreon page on patreon.com/Made to Parade. Also, keep your eye out on our social media sites for details of t-shirts that we're getting made. And I know a number of you have expressed an interest in those, so please make sure that you check those out when we make them available. If you want to take part in season 4, then get in touch with us, and we'd be only too happy to have you on board the podcast. Email me on madetheparadebook@gmail.com and we'll get in touch with you and see what we can do. Also, make sure you do check out the book. It's still available there, and it's the reason behind all the podcasts and the whole Made to Parade setup. Amazon for $9.99 paperback and $5.99 on Kindle version. So, all right, folks, that's it until next week. So, until then, look after yourselves, take it easy, and here's Billy Wade to play us out.